Sister Wendy Beckett was a Roman Catholic nun, which is an unlikely combination with art critic right out of the chute. She was an Oxford-educated person before she took orders. And you would have to add to that, in terms of her unlikely nature as an art critic, the fact that she did not look anything like a television celebrity. Like, whatever your trope is visually for a television celebrity, she was, like, not that. Just full-on not that. Most of her work with the BBC and the series, she made a couple of long series on the history of Western art for the BBC, which remain the most popular series they have ever done on art, to date. Just a huge success. She had sort of the trappings of a superstar in the sense that she had an agent and she had management and so on and so forth, but she also lived in a trailer on the grounds of her order her entire life and maintained the disciplines of the order in her personal life whenever possible, even though she was no longer formally in the order. And when she passed away in December 2018, that's where she was. She was on those grounds in her trailer. Most of what she did for the BBC in terms of how they produced it was unscripted. It was she carried this stuff about art and meaning around inside of her. It was quite amazing. And our kids all know Sister Wendy, and that's what they call her. They just call her Sister Wendy. She's like their buddy when it comes to art. You could take one of my kids into an art museum pretty much anywhere in the Western world, and they would see something or other and say, "Sister Wendy says," and go that direction with it, right? Because her words about Western art and its history are just part of their mental map for how this stuff works. And I don't know about this in any detail. It's totally speculative. But I suspect that the way Sister Wendy got into our house is I think she probably snuck in the side door of being on some homeschool resource list that was put together by some Christian or other that wanted their kids to get a classical education at home, which would, of course, include history of Western art, but they didn't want them to kind of get sucked into this wild and woolly art of, art criticism, right? So it's like, hey, how about a nun? How could that go wrong, right? And I'm not going to unpack that now, but I think that, like with, say, C.S. Lewis, another one of those like authors that shows up on similar sorts of lists, do people just not read the last book in the Chronicles of Narnia? Like, people have no idea how subversive this guy's thinking is in context. Same thing with Sister Wendy in art. She just had this remarkably subversive spirituality that was burbling along under the surface. And if you just stopped that religious person talking about art, fine. Like, she was still erudite about the art, and she did all this stuff for the BBC in her full habit. Like, that, you never saw her otherwise. That was just her garb. That was Sister Wendy Beckett. But it's like, I think a lot of people must have just kind of bounced off the surface, and they just weren't listening to what she was saying most of the time. This woman had a better grasp on things like human sensuality and the nature of the divine all present, and it's just this huge range. She was a big thinking person. I wasn't going to go into that, and you can feel the tug. I'm not going to. But I want to offer a quote that gives us a hint about how subversive her spirituality was, how pervasive her spirituality was. But I think it's also something that points toward a way of looking at the world that I think is helpful to anybody that ponders, like we've been doing these past few weeks, the distinction between things like religion and spirituality. So this is on prayer in particular. So this is Sister Wendy Beckett on prayer. So just listen to this and imagine for a moment that you're trying to protect your kids from the wiles of imaginative spirituality by showing them Sister Wendy Beckett. "The eye that sees nobility and beauty in what another would regard as ordinary is the eye of prayer." I'll read it for you again. "The eye that sees nobility and beauty in what another would regard as ordinary is the eye of prayer." So she just redefined prayer. And she redefined it as paying attention to beauty in the ordinary. That's prayer. Is that religious to pray like that? Is it spiritual to pray like that? Are those meaningful distinctives? So for Beckett, art was like a way of seeing, a window in on all the things that matter to us as humans. That was kind of her frame. And I mean, she's easily recognizable as a religious person, right? Like, there's the habit, and she had this, very memorable speech impediment as well. So my kids can still do Sister Wendy's particular inflection quite well. But you just take a glance at her and go, here's a religious person. But her way of seeing the world was, I think, remarkably forward-looking. In fact, when I think about the kind of what we've been talking in the last couple of weeks about what the contemporary culture means when it talks about this spiritual but not religious phrase, when I think about what we've been considering about that from current research in Canada, and I think about Beckett's idea of seeing nobility and beauty in what another would regard as ordinary, I think she was almost prescient about this stuff. It was like she could see it coming because she was just paying attention. And I think she would have been quite comfortable with the distinctives of spiritual but not religious that we talked about last week. And I suspect that she probably would have said when religion is behaving itself well, it should be hard to tell the difference. It's just that it usually doesn't. Right? Like if religion's actually doing its job, if we even take the language of the word religion, religamenting, we take its linguistic history, connecting that which is disconnected, and we think about religion as doing that, rather than separating into tribes that then have to compete for who gets to win the religious war. If religion behaved itself well, I don't know that you could tell the difference between it and spiritual, and the phrase would become meaningless. The words would just be interchangeable. But they're actually not, right? They're really not. It's a meaningful distinction because of the way we tend to practice the things we make, the ways we make culture, including the ways we make religion. I said that as part of setting up our conversation this morning, I was going to recap what we talked about last week. So I want to do that briefly in case you weren't here, and I know I didn't put up the podcast. It's going to happen eventually. These days, we talked about last week, this idea, and this again we were drawing on contemporary Canadian research from an institute at Queen's that studies spirituality and culture. And there were sort of these three distinctives we talked about that the research says people are leaning toward when they say, I'm spiritual but not religious. This is what they tend to mean. Okay? I'll just give them very briefly to us, and then we're going to do a little something with them. So these days when people say that they're spiritual, part of what they often mean is that they believe there is more to the world than meets the eye. There is more than what the author of the study I was referencing called mere material. So that's partly what, when people say I'm spiritual but not religious these days, that's part of what they tend to mean. More to the world than meets the eye. Second thing they often mean is that they wish to be people who attend to their interior life. So they want to pay attention to their mental and emotional and spiritual state, and the reason they want to do that is to gain a certain kind of self-knowledge. Know thyself is not a contemporary dictum, it's very old, but it still holds. So people these days that would say, I'm spiritual but not religious, one of the characteristics of that group of people is often that they attend to their interior life so that they can gain self-knowledge. Now, as we talked about last week, that can all look pretty self-absorbed, but the third characteristic that people tend to have when they say they're spiritual but not religious these days actually moves it from it's all about me into the wider world. The third characteristic is that they mean they value certain virtues, and these days the focus seems to be on virtues like being compassionate or empathetic or open-hearted. So the seeking for self-knowledge is for the reason or the purpose of being more effective in the wider world, living better in the wider world. So that kind of moves it from navel-gazing into I actually want to make a difference in the world. And I can't actually do that if I don't know something about myself. And the way that I come to know the things about myself that actually enable me to live wiser, more empathetically, more open-heartedly, more constructively, less reactively in the wider world, those things I gain knowledge of through spiritual practice. That's how that happens. So that's kind of what the research surfaces in terms of what people tend to have in mind when they say I'm spiritual but not religious. I don't find that stuff feeling especially foreign at all. I feel like yes, of course, right. So here's where I'd like to sort of begin our group exploration today. I would invite you to think about experiences that you have had that feel like they touch on some of the things that we just described, that feel like they have to do with experiencing the world in a way that's more than just what we can see and touch. And by the way, all of these things are things that I think it's fair to describe as human needs. We actually need the things that we were just talking about, but we can't necessarily manage them or make them behave a certain way. So this is where religion, I think, kind of goes off the rails. It starts to treat the spiritual as though we're the material, if you will. And that's and hive it off from the material, as opposed to this idea that everything happens inside of whatever we would use God language for, right? So think about experiences you've had that feel like they touch on those things, more than the material, that take you somehow to the interior of life, rather than the exterior, if we want to make that a binary, and that feel like they move you toward or moved you toward being a more open-hearted, less reactive person, toward being someone that is consciously empathetic, open-hearted, loving, connected, interconnected, those kinds of things. There doesn't need to be, in your reflection, these don't need to be experiences that resulted in some grand insight or lesson or message. In fact, they may well have brought more confusion than clarity. That happens when we go spiritually exploring, for sure. These are the stories that I was thinking of generally when I titled the blurb "The Box Under the Bed." It might take a little digging to get at these, depending on your story. Give yourself permission, as you try to think of experiences like this in your own life, for them to have happened in contexts you no longer feel like are your native space. Like we may well have had experiences like this in a context where we're now trying to re-understand that experience in another context, right? Especially if the context was religious. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater without some examination. It might be a good truism. So just give yourself permission to range widely in your memory while you're trying to think of experiences like this. And then I'll turn the off button on the recorder, and we can talk about some of those memories, okay? So if you're following along by podcast, this is where you have to do your own work. Bye, Mom. Thank you.